a colleague and I were sleeping out under the stars rather than under our little tarp. And I woke up to the feeling of like a dog sniffing my head. And I just kind of thought, and I had to do a little sense making at the moment of like, well, that's not a dog. It couldn't be a dog. And I just shut up.
This is the Adventure Sports Podcast, where we hear stories of adventure from every corner of the planet. We interview all sorts of folks who are using their sport to explore the world around them and give you the inspiration you need to get out there and have some fun. Hey folks, hope you had a good weekend. I'm your host, Mason Gravely. Today we're going to be talking to guest Ben Morton about doing a first descent of a river in Bhutan. And Ben is a very talented paddle sport enthusiast. He does guiding trips and trips all over the world, so I do want to plug that. You can find more about him at precisionpaddlesports.com. It just seems like a great teacher, a great guide, and does some pretty cool stories. But this trip in particular was really unique for him, so we're going to be focusing on the details of that trip later in the episode. But I also wanted to say this recommendation, having been on the show, was from a listener suggestion. Eric Barden, a listener, reached out to us with some contact info and said, hey, you should have this guy I know, Ben Morton, on your show. And if you don't know, that's how we primarily get guests for this show. Is listener recommendations or folks reach out to us. So if you know anybody, please reach out. You can send an email to info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And that's how we've gotten to 700 episodes, is folks reaching out and sending us suggestions. So thanks, Eric, and thanks, Ben, for being on the show. And when we start the episode, I had already asked Ben, hey, where are you from? What did you grow up doing? And so he's in the middle of answering that question. So without further ado, here is the episode.
Well, you know, Mason, I grew up in rural Virginia, so a really small county, Orange, Virginia, which is kind of tucked right up against the Blue Ridge Mountains. And so it's really beautiful. I really wasn't into, you know, adventure sports, but more traditional sport. And so while like my buddies and I would goof off on the river during the summertime, like tubing and swimming, most of my time was spent, you know, trying out traditional sports. And eventually I kind of gravitated towards soccer. And so I ended up like really getting into that heavily. I think it wasn't until I was a teenager that, you know, my mom started to get into doing some recreational kayaking. And because my mom had a couple around, my brother and I started to dabble, but it wasn't something that particularly interested me at the time.
Oh, interesting. So what made your mom get into it?
Yeah, it was, you know, really interesting. My mom is an amazing person, but she was, I think sometime, you know, I don't know if it was a midlife crisis, what initiated it, but she started going with a friend over to the New River Gorge in West Virginia and doing a lot of rafting and camping out. And at the time she was like, well, whitewater kayaking is not my deal, but, you know, just some general recreational kayaking in a more mellow environment is totally something that she was interested in. So I think that kind of seeing other people kayaking was what started it off. And then once she got into it, she really got bit by the bug.
Oh man. So she was bit and you were a teenager, but it took you a while to get into it. But you know, it's something I'm sure you never thought would become such a big part of what you do. When did you start to get bit by the bug?
It was really interesting. I mean, I don't know how interesting for me that I kind of pursued soccer as heavily as I could for a long time. And, you know, when it came to going to college, I wasn't quite at the level that I wanted to be to play, wanted to go. And so I just kind of had this kind of moment where I stepped back and was like, well, I think I'm going to like walk away from soccer, at least being competitive. And so I was just lost. I mean, I had no sense of what I wanted to study or anything of the sort. But, you know, here comes mom again saying, hey, you know what? I meet these young folks over in West Virginia that study outdoor education as, you know, as a major in college. And I couldn't wrap my mind around it, but I just, you know, I had no idea, but I was like, oh, that sounds great. I want to do it. But then kind of came into like trying to unpack and figure out what exactly is, you know, outdoor education and adventure sports. And so, I knew at that moment I was enjoying being outside, and, you know, a friend and I started taking my mom's kayaks out more frequently. And at some point in that moment or in that time frame, my mom was like, you know, Ben, you're taking these kayaks out on rivers that probably aren't suitable for the kayaks. Like, maybe you should consider getting a whitewater kayak and taking a class. And so that sent me down to Fredericksburg, Virginia, where I took a kind of like a evening class from a guy that was going to college there at Mary Washington. And as soon as I got on the water with that guy, he was charismatic. He was a very skilled kayaker. I was immediately told myself, I want to do what that guy's doing. And so from that moment moving forward, I just kind of stayed heavily into kayaking and then branched off into other adventure sports as well.
Wow, that's awesome. So did you end up studying that field, like outdoor recreation, and just kind of advancing in that through college?
Yeah, so I ended up, like, in that time frame, I had taken a gap year after I finished high school. And so that was where I just started going off on all these kind of micro adventures with a buddy of mine. And we were just, you know, unconsciously incompetent. Like, we had no idea what we knew and what we didn't know. And so in that time, we were going out kayaking, we were going out on hiking trips. And then my mom and I were going to a climbing gym in Charlottesville, Virginia, like twice a week. And so I was getting a sense of a variety of outdoor activities, and I was getting just really excited. And so in that gap year, I also saved up my money and was able to participate in a North Carolina Outward Bound outdoor leader course. And that's really kind of what sealed the deal. That helped give me a small foundation of formal, you know, outdoor education experience. And after I left that, I was like, this is totally what I want to do. I'm absolutely sure of it. And so I ended up going to Garrett College in Western Maryland and studying adventure sports and leadership and just accumulating a lot of great experiences and just getting inundated with all sorts of ideas and excitement for trips and things that I could do in the future.
Man, that's really cool because, you know, we talk to a lot of people on this show that, you know, they're trying to make a career out of what they love to do. It's really challenging, you know, if there's not a market for it or there's no, you know, not necessarily knowing how to do that, whether it's through guiding or what. In the world of kayaking and through kind of the knowledge and what you were gaining, how are you seeing that path like unfold? Was it through guiding or was it through you know, something else within kayaking? What did you see and what were you being taught to look for?
Well, I think, you know, I've been kind of told the narrative that so many people are told that, you know, you can go out and work in the field for a while, but at some point, you know, you're going to need to step into a more administrative role. And, you know, there's very few jobs to make a career in the outdoor field. And I guess I just kind of accepting of it, but I was just like, well, I'm going to enjoy my time when I'm out in the field and working. But what I just kind of gathered through the years is like, it's a puzzle. It's an absolute puzzle to piece together your ideal job or your ideal career. But every year it got easier where I feel like at the beginning, I was like paying, you know, employers to get the opportunity to work for them. And then after I got my foot in the door, you know, being able to demonstrate a work ethic, a skill set, an attitude, what have you, then all of a sudden, you know, more opportunities came up where I was being paid rather than paying to get the opportunity to work. And so I tried to check my ego whenever an opportunity came up and just said, hey, if this feels right, you know, go for it, regardless of whether or not you're going to get paid, you know. And I just figured that accumulating that really diverse and solid foundation of experience would lead to good things.
So how has that feeling served you looking back however many years now?
You know, I guess, you know, I've been out there doing it, piecing it together for about 15 or so years. And I tell you, Mason, it feels good. I mean, I work in the outdoors. I'm not rolling in the cash. I always have concerns about whether or not work is going to fill in the gaps each year, but every year it seems to get easier in terms of scheduling and booking courses and workshops. I think for a long time it was very sustainable for me because I was willing to travel, and I was willing to travel anywhere. And so I would hop on a plane or I would drive, and I had a very nomadic lifestyle just for work for quite some time. And, you know, now I'm married and, you know, have a daughter and we're based here in Vermont. And so I'm less apt to travel. But a good friend told me once, he's like, you know, you just have to keep your foot on the gas pedal, because at some point in time, a lot of the people, a lot of your peers or colleagues are going to step away because it gets so challenging. But if you're willing to hang in, like, next thing you know, you're going to be the name. And it feels like that has rung true in a number of ways. And that, like, I just get I get a phone call and someone runs into my name on a website or on a blog, and that starts a conversation about a potential work opportunity. And so It's certainly nothing that I'm doing in terms of marketing. I'm awful at marketing and social media,
you're just consistent, and the longevity is what you can do. Man, I can't tell you, the podcasting world's so similar. Like, I'm seeing competing shows or shows that are similar, maybe not competitors necessarily, but I'm seeing that happen as well, like shows dropping off or quitting, you know, for whatever reason, for good reasons. You know, they've got to move on for whatever reason in life. And it's like, all right, if we can just keep going and keep making this thing happen, eventually we're kind of the only show in town, so people are going to listen.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned that you know, for a while there, a long time, you were willing to just go anywhere and do anything. You know, where were some of the places that kayaking took you?
You know, Mason, I started off there in Virginia, and then in college as well, I was, you know, kind of in that mid-Atlantic region. And so, you know, even in, you know, my backyard of, you know, West Virginia and some of the areas of Virginia and Maryland, you know, I just had some, you know, really amazing experiences. But I've just been super fortunate. I've been able to, for quite a while, I was working in the Rocky Mountain West and then the Pacific Northwest, specifically, you know, in Northern California on the Salmon River in California and the Southern Oregon and the Rogue River, just, you know, the Middle Fork of the Salmon in Idaho. They're just some absolutely amazing places to spend time and to be able to work. I've been able to work in quite a few states throughout the U.S. And so there's not too many regions in the U.S. that I haven't spent time in, fortunately. But, you know, I've also been really fortunate to travel overseas and to teach some courses in Europe. I've led trips down to Costa Rica for about 7 years now. And I've also been fortunate enough to go over to Asia and to spend some time in Australia and New Zealand. And so it's been a very rewarding and rich experience thus far, and just excited to keep it going.
Man, what an adventure. Was there any place that you got to go to that really, really captured you, really captured your heart, or a place that's just its own level in your eyes?
You know, I will say that every time I go to New Zealand, I say, like, this could be a place that I could live so easily. And I've got amazing friends there. But just generally, the people that I've met there are just so thoughtful, sweet. And I just love the landscape. It speaks to me for sure. I've been working in Costa Rica long enough now that the folks that I work with there feel like family. And so I'm excited to go down there, and it feels like another level when I go down there because of this genuine excitement to work with the folks I work with down there. And leading trips just doesn't feel like work. It just feels like play with those folks.
You know, and just so folks know, these are You're going down to these places and you're guiding. You're guiding mostly whitewater or rafting trips and kayaking, like guided trips. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'd say the high majority of what I'm doing is whitewater kayaking. So in whitewater kayak instruction or leading a trip. Certainly in New Zealand, my time there has been, a lot of it has just been personal kayaking with friends. But I've had the opportunity to stay at the New Zealand kayak school for an extended period of time and just shadow and observe and assist in not a formal working capacity, but just as a opportunity for professional development. And that was a hugely rich experience.
If you don't mind, I'd love to hear a story about, you know, maybe traveling, going with a group to some of these places and where something went, something was scary for you as a guide or as the leader. Maybe not something that went wrong or tragic, but just a time where maybe it just tested your skills.
You know, I worked for Knowles for quite a while out in Utah, working on the Green River, going through Desolation Canyon. And there was one particular year, a colleague of mine, we kind of had this saying that Desolation Canyon was trying to kill me. And it was, it was due to, you know, on two back-to-back trips, we were one morning, I wake up super early in the morning and I went down to our big group kitchen and I start making coffee with my headlamp. And then while the coffee is being made, I go grab a kayak and drag it down to the river's edge. And then I go visit the Groover and then I come back. And at this point, as I'm in the kitchen, the sun is starting to come up and we start having some students move around. And we, you know, I kind of from the kitchen, I see some students hanging around a particular part of the beach. And I go down and just see what's up. And they're like, hey, what kind of prints are these? And they were pretty big size cat print. And we followed them and they were following my footsteps from the time that I was in the kitchen in the morning to the time that I went, took the kayak down to the river's edge. The time I went to the Groover, this cat had just been walking behind me at some distance, I'd imagine. But yeah, just to have the idea that a big cat was stalking me in the early morning hours in Utah was a little startling. And then the following trip, a colleague and I were sleeping out under the stars rather than in our under our little tarp, and I woke up to the feeling of like a dog sniffing my head, and I just kind of thought, and I had to do a little sense making at the moment of like, well, that's not a dog, it couldn't be a dog, and I just shot up, and you know, it was a bear that was just checking my head out, and as soon as I shot up, it started to run out.
So, holy cow, are you serious? Right on your head?
Right on my head. And so that was at that point, you know, the joke was heavily enshrined that Dessa was trying to kill me.
Oh my dude, are you serious? Holy cow. I didn't realize those, you know, like a mountain lion and a bear were down in that canyon. That is wild. Jeez.
Yeah. I they're certainly around. The black bear in some areas there can be a real nuisance during the summertime, But this was shoulder season, so a lot less traffic going down the river, and so a lot more wildlife down and around. And so, yeah.
Oh my gosh, man, that is crazier than I expected, and it wasn't even in the water, is what was the crazy part. You know,
this is in camp. Yeah, I feel like I've had a number of challenging situations in the river environment, but that's kind of par for the course. I feel like you just that comes with the territory. Another reason that, you know, I just try to stay sharp on the skills and so that I can react to those situations with somewhat ease. I it's what I strive for, at least.
Yeah, you're an expert in the water, but you know, there's no book about how to deal with bears at camp sniffing your head. You just kind of have to rely on instincts at that point and do your best. So speaking of that, how have you been able to manage risk over the years in the water? What you know, your views are, obviously you get better, you get more skilled in your whitewater abilities, but how do you manage that? Because I hear a lot of people, especially when they become, you know, a parent, a mom or dad, they decide to get out of whitewater just because it's so dangerous. How have you been able to stick with it?
Well, I'd say, you know, professionally, like when I'm working, I just say that over the years, I've probably just naturally become more conservative, and that's based on prior experiences and then the experiences of colleagues of mine that that just really strike home the very real risks involved. And I think I really work hard to make decisions that are appropriate for the specific people that I'm working with. But yeah, generally I just have a very low tolerance for minor injuries and certainly major injuries. And so I do what I can to manage the risk to avoid those if possible. I know that random things can happen, but I really err on the side of kind of conservative judgment and decision making at this point. And then for myself, there was a time where I certainly was interested in challenging myself as, you know, as much as I possibly could. But yeah, through kind of reevaluating my own interests and desires for the sport, after having a family, it's like I still very much love, absolutely love being on the water. But my tolerance for risk is certainly down a notch or so. I still like to push myself, but I just find different ways to push myself that allow me a bit of a buffer so that if I do have a slip up or a mishap, that the consequences aren't dire.
That's always a good direction to be going in everything. Yeah. But yeah, I totally get it, man. And that's, you know, I'm definitely digging because I'm a dad too, and I'm seeing my risk tolerance change. But you know what's interesting is I see my risk tolerance changing, but my enjoyment for anything isn't going down. It's changing as well. You know what I mean? Like I enjoy it just as much, if not more, even though I'm not maybe heading so recklessly all the time. That's been an interesting observation.
Absolutely. I'm with you.
Ben, we originally reached out wanting to hear about this specific adventure you did, just kind of some details about it. But you did this first descent in Bhutan on this section of a river. And I just kind of want to hear about that, how that project came about, what it was exactly, and maybe why it was so meaningful to you and why it was so important to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, this trip to Bhutan was put together by a couple that I have worked with extensively over the years, Mary and Phil DeRemer, and they own DeRemer Adventure Kayaking. And so I worked with them throughout the U.S. with these kind of raft-supported whitewater kayak trips going down all these classic runs like the Rogue River, the Middle Fork of the Salmon, the Main Salmon, the going through the Colorado in the Grand Canyon. But they also run trips in Bhutan. And I'd expressed interests, you know, early on, hey, if there's ever an opportunity to come over there, I would love to work with y'all there. And so after a few years, an opportunity did present itself, and that Phil wanted to lead a trip, a really extensive trip in Bhutan that started on the west side of Bhutan and, you know, traveled through the middle of Bhutan all the way to the eastern side of Bhutan, and then ultimately culminated with this first descent of the Kuri Chu River, of the lower Kuri Chu. At the time, Mary was not interested in paddling at the level that was going to be necessary to paddle all those rivers, or at least she wasn't comfortable being in the role of guiding those trips. And so Phil asked if I'd be interested, and recognizing that I hadn't been over there, my role wasn't going to be as much of a guide as it was going to be more of a safety boater and just an extra hand. And so, yeah, I jumped at the opportunity. And so this is back in 2015. And we had a really great quality group of folks that just interpersonally, they were really, everybody jived socially. And then we got to paddle in some absolutely amazing places. I mean, Bhutan is just an extraordinary place. And so while the traveling throughout the entire country was exhaustive, you know, to be able to culminate with this first descent was something that was just kind of the excitement that was kind of lying underneath the entire time. It was the end of the trip, towards the end of the trip, I guess, on a 16-day trip, where this was day 14 that we launched on the Kurichu. And the logistics were complicated because we were starting obviously in Bhutan, but we were going to take off the river in India. And so this meant a lot of things for the folks that were helping us with our logistics. But for us, it meant, hey, we just need to go on the river and we have to get down to the takeout, because that's where our buses, our passports, the whole nine yards are going to be. And so we got to the area 2 days prior, and we paddled a section of the Kurichu that was what we considered to be the middle Kurichu, which was kind of a step down in difficulty from the rivers that we had been paddling for the past 2 weeks. And so more in we had been paddling kind of in the class 4, maybe occasional 4+ range. And this was like class 3, not very technical. And so we kind of thought like, hey, the lower Kurichu, based on the Google images and all the info that we could get, we think it's going to be a step down. So it could be a pretty low stress experience for folks. And so when we packed our boats for the 2 nights that we were going to spend out there, we were feeling good about, hey, like this is probably going to be a little bit of a step down, and we're going to see a beautiful place that nobody else has seen before. And so not long after we launched and got on the water, I started realizing like, hey, there's a little bit more going on than I think we all had imagined. And on that first day, just the difficulty just kind of slowly ramped up and up and up. And at the end of that first day, we had a real scare where we got to a rapid that from the top, initially, it didn't look like it could be run, and it didn't look like it could be portaged. So it looked like we could be in a real pinch. Fortunately, we were able to find a way to portage around an unrunnable portion of the rapid, and then we're going to be able to slide in and paddle kind of the second half of the rapid. But still, a very juicy, very challenging rapid that we had to navigate that second half. And in that process, one of our participants flipped over and got pushed up against the cliff wall and just disappeared out of our sight for a pretty long time. And I it's difficult to gauge it's very difficult to gauge the length of time in a scenario like that, you know, because seconds feel like minutes and minutes feel like hours. And so I would imagine it was probably for about 3 minutes we didn't have eyes on him or his gear. And you know, the worst possible things are going through my mind in that moment. Man,
that's torture.
It was. And from the position we were in, myself and Phil were unable to get back up to be able to do anything. However, we still had a Bhutanese guide, Tinley, that was with us. And Tinley was going to be the last one to go on that rapid. So he was able to scramble around on the cliff's edge and see down that that this participant had he had flipped over and gotten pushed into a very precarious eddy that was right up against the cliff that, you know, was very challenging for anybody else to see. But he was out of his boat, but he and his boat and his paddle were all in the eddy. And so Tinley was able to help get him back up. But the challenging thing was that he had to run the rapid again because there was no way around it. And just fortunately, this guy had a rock solid mind. You know, he just didn't like, he was able to stay kind of emotionally detached in that moment. And he just put back on, got in his kayak and peeled out of the eddy and made the move just barely. And we all had a good celebration when he got down to the bottom of the rapid. But yeah, I think that particular experience just ramped up the volume of stress and intensity. And we were only into the first day. And so fortunately that night, you know, we were able to find a camp just downstream from that rapid. And we had a gorgeous night, you know, cooking over fires and just, you know, able to kind of share some excitement for the experience. But there was a lot of nervous energy going into that day too. What was worse is that our Bhutanese guide, Tinley, ended up getting quite sick that night. And he was really, really sick. I mean, just, you know, food poisoning, something of the sort that really hindered his ability to be a productive part of the group for the following day. He was able to get down the river, but he was no longer able to work as a guide or provide any type of safety component for the group. He was really just trying to take care of himself. And that second day, Mason was action packed. It was back in 2015. My memory is not spot on, but it felt like there were about 20 plus rapids that were in the class four plus range. You know, this being at the end of a 2 week trip, the guests on the trip were just gassed. And so I remember Phil and I having people walk around numerous rapids, and then we'd kayak down the rapid, and then we'd get out, run back up, kayak their kayak down the rapid, and then get them back in their boat. Or in some rapids, we would just carry their boat around the rapid for them. And so this happened, and it was daunting. And people were, I think, you know, it being a first descent and the unknowns that go along with that, people were definitely getting stressed towards the afternoon. And I think that if it couldn't have gotten worse, it did when, you know, we'd been in a very remote area, but all of a sudden you started to see what looked like crews up on the cliff. And what they were doing is they were blowing out the parts of the cliff in order to build a road that they've been working on for quite some time. And so, you know, I have to scream down to Phil at one point because he didn't see what was going on just above us, you know, hundreds of feet above us, but still above us, where, you know, these folks were just hucking rocks off of the cliff. And so we were then trying to go from one side of the river to the next to avoid any potential rockfall. But, you know, Mason, you know, it was a trying day, but we ended up getting to the confluence of the Drogmechu, which was a known river for Phil. He'd paddled that river a number of times. And so once we got to the confluence, we knew what was ahead of us. We paddled for quite some time that evening before we got to our camp. But the unknown and the most challenging part of the trip was behind us. And so there was a level of kind of sigh of relief. But yeah, I mean, there's so many nitty-gritty micro stories within those 2 days. But we woke up from that second night's camp and had a short paddle down and took out on the river left side, which was India. And yeah, we had one night stay in India before flying out and wrapping up the trip.
Wow. There's so much I'm curious about, just because I don't know much about this, but, you know, a first descent is, you know, much like a first ascent in the sense that no one's paddled this route before. And it probably started to feel, hey, there's a reason it's a first descent with all this unforeseen thing. So can I ask you this? Were you really familiar with first descents at that point? You know, obviously, I imagine some of the challenges would be not really having a guidebook or not really knowing what to expect necessarily. I might be wrong. I don't know.
No, I think you're accurate. Like, hey, at that point in time, you know, I personally had no known first descents. However, you know, Phil Dreamer, I mean, he's such a mentor and friend of mine. I consider him family, and he has just got the most impressive, he and his partner, Mary, have the most impressive experiences in first descents and exploration. And so it was really his level of leadership and just confidence that made me, instead of feeling uneasy, I just kind of felt like, hey, I just need to rise to the occasion and just be whatever support that Phil needs in this moment. And so, yeah, that gave me a lot of comfort in that moment or at that time. But yeah, the unknowns were certainly the kind of the stressor. And yeah, there's only so much, like, you know, you try to gain as much local knowledge as you can, but that particular area and stretch of river had no roads. And so there was very little local knowledge that we could pull from. And so then we're looking at Google Images and Google Earth and trying to get as much as we can with satellite images. But depending on the time of year that those images were taken, it's really hard to gauge, you know, hey, what's this going to look like? Is that a rapid? What's that going to look like? And so, yeah, it just more than we bargained for. But at the end of the day, it was not beyond what the trip was marketed as, which was a relief, you know, because if we had had people down there that were way outside of their comfort zone, it would have been a big stressor. But the folks that we had, while maybe some fatigue like led to them walking around rapids, most of those rapids were straightforward enough that the folks on the trip could have gotten down had they been fresh. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of things going on. You know, at the end of the trip, you're in a different country, and then you're on a first descent. It's yeah, and one of your guides is very ill, and so there's a lot of stressors going on.
No kidding, man. That does sound stressful. And so, if I like you're saying, a few of the people there were essentially clients, so you were in charge of their safety and well-being, and a lot of their logistics, and having to take that on yourself on a first descent, that's tough.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, all the credit goes to Phil Dreamer. I mean, he's an absolutely amazing trip leader and guide and instructor. And I think I looked at him after we got to the confluence and finished the lower Curichu. And I just said, you know, I think this was probably the most significant moment in my outdoor leadership, paddle sport, guiding, like all these different roles. Like this was one of the, if not the most significant experience of my career and life. Like this, it was an enormous experience to reflect on and to try to pull learnings from, because there were just so many.
I can imagine. Would you say this was, for all your experiences, unique in a way? Involved certain things that other trips did not?
It was unique being a first descent, and the fact that, you know, professionally, you know, being in charge and taking people down as a part of a first descent was certainly outside of the realm of normal for me. And yeah, I think, you know, I think that now that experience is kind of unique, because I'm, you know, just through where I'm at with my own work, is that I'm seldom the assistant and I'm more the lead. So it's like I have to really be on top of my game, because I don't have that absolutely amazing mentor to look up to in that moment. I have to be that person. And so it just makes me really stay sharp. And so that it was a unique experience on a number of fronts.
Was there anything you learned on that trip that you didn't want to repeat? Maybe like, okay, I don't want to do that anymore.
I don't think so. I mean, that trip was day to day. There were small stressors. I think it made me check my own like professional tolerance for risk. Like, hey, do I feel comfortable taking people on first descents? And you know, for me, like, because of my limited experience, you know, pursuing first descents, that answer was no. Like, hey, I'm all on board. Anytime Phil Dreamer wants to do something like this, I will be his, you know, right-hand man whenever. But for me to be in the position of the designated leader, that was something I said, yeah, not until I, you know, increase my first descent resume a bit.
With whitewater kayaks, you know, there, if anyone isn't familiar, and again, I don't know much, you can correct anything I say wrong, they're just kind of those snub-nosed looking kayaks that are real short, maneuverable. But you guys were touring, so you were taking all your equipment with you, your camping gear and your food. I don't see that a lot. I don't see a lot of people traveling in those. You know, there's a thing called touring kayaks that I'm more used to. Does it change anything logistically or maneuverability wise when you're carrying everything yourself?
Yeah, absolutely, Mason. So yeah, you're absolutely right. Like whitewater kayaks can vary in length, but generally, you know, whitewater kayaks are kind of in that, you know, 8 to 10 foot range, or at least the kayaks that we were using. And they have a lot of rocker, meaning that there's quite a lot of bow to the bottom of the boat, so that the boat has less boat down in the water, which makes it more maneuverable. As such, it does not want to paddle in a straight line very much, and so you really have to work to paddle it. You've got to drive the boat where you want it to go. But you're right that they're not designed per se for, at least the boats that we were using were not designed per se for these kind of self-support kayak trips. However, through thoughtful planning, and figuring out, you know, how we can divide up group gear and food and the like, and then being really thoughtful about how we pack the boats, we're able to do that. And so the boats, certainly as small as they are heavily affected as soon as you put weight into the ends of them. And so the challenge is like being thoughtful about your weight distribution and trying to really focus weight towards the center of the boat as much as possible. But absolutely, they definitely paddle a bit differently when they're loaded down with a little bit of extra weight, which, yeah, was another added stressor for folks as we navigated some of these rapids.
What were some of the misconceptions about traveling somewhere to do an adventure? Because, you know, from my experience, every time you got these maps, you're planning, you have this image in your head of what the place is going to be like and what the people are going to be like. And never is the reality even close. Not in a good or bad way. It's just totally different than your imagination was perceiving it. Was that the experience you had out there, or had you had experience out there before?
I had not had experience in Bhutan before, but, you know, I've been able to travel enough to just, you know, for my personal experience is often that, you know, by the time I, you know, find a kayak to buy in a country, by the time I figure out like the use of a vehicle or something of the sort and figure out the details of getting to a river and the water levels that need to be at, you know, that need to work, I find that it's so much easier just going to an outdoor center of some sort and, you know, being able to work with folks there, you know, because for me, I guess if you've got an abundance of time, you can sort those details out yourself. And I think that it can be more economical to do that. But if you've got a small window of time, you know, your time is your money. And so you want to maximize your time as much as possible. And so I think in those moments, just going to an outdoor center and trying to get, you know, renting a kayak and trying to get your logistics worked through that center, it might cost a little bit more, but gosh, if you've got a limited amount of time, then that seems well worth it from my experience. And that's what the folks on this trip to Bhutan, these folks that were paying us, you know, they had a limited amount of time. I mean, just getting to Bhutan and then getting back home is going to take a number of days. And so, you know, they didn't have the time or the resources to kind of figure things out on the ground. So, you know, they hired the outfitter that I was working with, Dreamer Adventure Kayaking, to essentially have all those details ironed out. And then so for me, having worked with Phil and Mary for years within the U.S., I knew exactly what I was going to be walking into in terms of just professionalism and expectations around lodging and so on and so forth. And so there wasn't a lot of surprise outside of just visiting a new country. But I tell you what, I mean, Bhutan is just an absolutely amazing country to visit. I was, you know, the people were so welcoming, so thoughtful and sweet. And I, you know, I absolutely loved it.
Was there any unforeseen dangers, you know, kind of like your story with the mountain lion and the bear that wasn't involved in the water? I know the blasting of the road was, you know, you can't even plan for that. Like, how, you know, but it's obviously a huge danger. Was there anything else like that pops up or tends to pop up with water-based trips like you've experienced?
In Costa Rica, like my guard is always up for poisonous snakes. Like I just, you know, I'm just, I've seen them so many times there that I know they're around and I know they can be big and they can be aggressive. And so I'm always hypersensitive to snakes in Costa Rica. But I tell you that last night, that second night on that first descent in Bhutan, at that point, you know, we'd finished the lower Kurichu and we were on the Drongmachu, which is, you know, a known river for Phil and for other folks. It is a river that's paddled somewhat often for camping. And I mean, at this point we're like in like the tropical jungle. We are in tiger country. And that was known. We are in tiger country. And so, you know, we were camped up on a beach on the side of the river and we've got our tarp set up and a number of us are sleeping under the tarp. We've got a little fire going and, you know, in the middle of the night, I wake up and hearing hearing some sort of a growling and a movement in the tree line. And I just, in my mind, I was just like, all right, what are you going to do? Like, are you going to go, you know, trying to mentally coach myself for an interaction with a tiger, which I would have never prepared for. But I'm still rehearsing in my mind, like, okay, you're going to go grab a log from the fire, you know, trying to essentially emulate what I've seen on Hollywood movies. But yeah, fortunately, our Bhutanese guide, Timlay, started throwing rocks out there. And I was like, Timlay, you know, what are you doing? Like, oh my God. And he's like, oh, it's a barking deer. And so what we thought was, a tiger looming in the tree line was an innocent barking deer. So yeah, it
holy cow,
a pleasant surprise in that regard.
Dude, that is funny. Just that's how it is, man. Out there in the woods, out there, you know, I'll be sitting out there and thinking, you know, some huge animal's in the leaves, and it's a lizard or something small, and think,
yeah, exactly.
What was I? It was just totally quiet, and it totally magnifies the effect. And I'm dramatic as it is, so. It was a tiger, you know. I'll turn it into that. But
that's right.
That's funny, man. That's so funny. So you know, coming back home and kind of just continuing your career and life forward. What do you think the biggest lesson was you learned from that experience in Bhutan?
I think that Phil just modeled so well what leading an amazing trip looked like. You know, just from his, you know, social engagement with every participant, his just genuinely thoughtful communication with all of the Bhutanese folks that we worked with, and just his ability and leadership on the water. I just way thinking like, wow, that is my mental model of a whitewater trip leader. And so I'd say that was one of the most significant take homes. I think for me, it reinforced reinforced the value of having a high level of tolerance for those, you know, adverse moments of like, hey, like, you know, there's a lot of unknowns that are going down, that we're going to experience downstream. I just couldn't let myself get wrapped up in it. I just had to stay in the moment and just try to be a model for the guests. And yeah, I think that it just reinforced the value of that characteristic of tolerance for adversity.
You know, what do you have going on now? What are some things you're doing looking forward to? I know kids change a lot of things for folks, but, you know, could you just talk about how life has been since that trip and how people can find out more about you and maybe join you on one of your adventures?
Oh yeah. So, you know, my family and I recently relocated to Vermont. So we're living in the Green Mountains just outside of Waitsfield, Vermont on the Mad River, which is an amazing place to be. We're absolutely loving it. And so nowadays I work mostly for myself. I have a small business, Precision Paddle Sports, and I stay busy between providing, you know, private instruction for folks that just contact me that have very specific interests, as well as I do a lot of work with local colleges, providing staff training as well as working with the college students. And I travel around and I teach quite a few American Canoe Association instructor workshops. And so I do that for whitewater kayaking, canoeing, and paddleboarding. And I just finished one for stand-up paddleboarding here in Vermont this past weekend. I also lead trips down in Costa Rica. This year we're taking a break from it just for one season, but we plan on getting back after it in 2021. And so those are whitewater trips in Costa Rica.
Fantastic. How experienced do you have to be to go on some of these? I'm sure there's a threshold.
Yeah, you know, I just find that the trips that I lead in Costa Rica, I find to lead the most full throttle trips possible and you know, very quickly realize like I don't really have the tolerance for this type of risk to put people in and be in charge of other people in these types of environments. And so we ask folks to have a reliable kayak role and to be comfortable in the class three environment for the trips that I lead down in Costa Rica. And then certainly if you're interested in more difficult, paddling more difficult whitewater down there in Costa Rica, while it wouldn't be on a trip with me, the folks that I work with down there are very happy to personalize people's experiences and trips down there.
Awesome, Ben. Well, great, man. I'm going to plug all that and make sure folks know where to find you and where to find out what you're doing and some of the things that some of the adventures you could bring some of the listeners along with. But yeah, man, I know you got a little one at home. I know I do too. And, you know, maybe close to bedtime. So I'm going to let you go. But thank you so much for jumping on, telling your story, or, you know, one little tiny story out of just probably the thousands you could tell. So I appreciate you diving into it a little bit and just telling us what you've learned from your experiences. This was really fun.
Mason, I really appreciate the opportunity. And yeah, just thank you so much.
Awesome, man. Well, I'll let you know if we're ever up there. I'd love to connect. You seem like just a great teacher. So I'd love to learn from you.
Anytime. Take care. And thanks again, Mason.
Yes, sir. All right. Talk soon, Ben. I'll let you know when this comes out.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.